first of all, thanks the organizers for inviting me here to give me a chance to present some of our, some of our latest results. And actually the title is very general, and the reason is that I decided to show you several aspects. The main talk will be this part here. There's a recent NMR studies on iron selenium addressing the question, what's really the reason for the magneticity in this compound? And I hope I can convince you that heating magnetism does not play a major role. And at the end, if there's time, also address a little bit the question, what's about interplay between orbitals or structure and and magnetism in other nictites like the 1111 compounds, and also there, I think there's a strong difference to that what we all know from, most of you know from the 1-2 compounds, where we have these pneumatic fluctuations. But before I go to the NMR stuff, I would share some recent results on photo emission measurements which have been done in our group, which I believe could give us some hint or some evidence how to describe these systems. And we think that we have evidence for observation of this lower Hubble band, and this comes from a comparison between these experimental data to theoretical calculations. And it's great that Silke is also here, because she's really the source of these calculations. So what we're addressing here, this photo emission, is the question, what are the signatures in photo emission from the large correlations? Of course, we know these iron-based superconductors are not Hubble insulators, so we wouldn't expect something like that. But they are also not describable the simple band structure theory, so we also do not expect something like that. So we're in between, and this question is just addressed by this team. So most of the experiments have been done by us, by the ARPIS team, that's headed by Zagreb Borisenko, which whom many of you probably know. And PhD student Janek Malec, and the postdoc Liu for our group, and then the crystals came from Karlsruhe in this case. And I saw that this has already been discussed here during this conference. It's a very nice crystals. And theory is done, okay, DFT calculations by Sasha Jaresko. And then we have, I think, three people who are involved in this DMFT calculations, which will be crucial. So usually what you look at, if you do ARPIS on these nictites, you focus on the energy region close to the Fermi energy, and then you see some bands, and then you compare them with DFT calculations. What you have to do, you have to shift, you have to squeeze them, and what you end up is a randomization factor, which is typically of the order of 3. And this by itself is already not trivial, because if you take, for example, a 1-2 structure, and instead of iron you replace nickel, and you do the same kind of experiment, you can see bands in the large energy range. And if you then compare it with DFT, you come to the conclusion that the randomization is weak if there's any at all, so randomization factor is of the order of 1. And I show you this data in order to show you that you can really follow bands in a rather large energy range. And that's also the case if you do many, many experiments on many non-correlated systems like this dichalcogenides or the topological insulators and so on. So it's no problem to follow sharp features usually in a large energy range, and you can compare them then with typical calculations from band structure calculations. And this is different in the iron-based superconductors. And this is the example now for the iron selenium. Here again, the Fermi surfaces. So in this case, hole pockets and electron pockets are very small. Details have been discussed in this paper from our group. You also see superconductivity in these compounds. So these are spectra measured at 9 Kelvin, 7 Kelvin, 5 Kelvin, 3. So you really see this coherence peak, superconducting coherence peak. So it's really very nice sample, very nice data, close to Fermi energy. Now, if you now take data in a larger energy range, you typically observe something like that. So you have these very sharp bands, so forming this Fermi surface, showing superconductivity close to the Fermi energy. And these are now measurements at different photon energies. And this has been done in order to convince people that matrix elements do not really play a crucial role for that, what I will discuss in a minute. So we also have measured the different polarizations, just trying to get rid of these additional complications coming from matrix elements. So what you see in all these spectra is, okay, you have these sharp quasi particles close to the Fermi energy. That's fine, and again, you can can discuss polymerization. That's pretty large in this iron selenium, so it's above 3. And for one, it's orbital dependent, of course, and then for one band, it's even a little bit larger. But fine, that's as usual. But then what you see then is a range, or an energy range, where there is no or strong depletion of spectral rate. So we lose a signal. And then at even larger energies, again, very broad things come up here, which still show some kind of dispersion. And then at even lower energies, additional things come up. So that's quite characteristic. And what you can see here, that it's not just for one peculiar energy or for one peculiar matrix element. That's really very general. And that's seen here in iron selenium. It's very nicely seen in iron selenium. But it's also seen already in other compounds, other iron-based superconductors. That's taken again also from a recent publication from our group. And you see the same phenomenology. It's not that clear like in iron selenium, therefore I will not discuss these other systems anymore in the minute. But again, here you have this sharp, renormalized band, squeezed bands close to the Fermi energy. Then you have a range where you lose spectral rate, and then some additional broad things comes up at higher energies, binding is typical of 2. Yeah?
If we are allowed, yeah. Very complicated. There are for different incident energies, ATV, yeah. 160. So, simple question is this: if we don't see something at one particular energy and we see some spectral rate at other energy, how should we interpret it?
Forget about that. The details I will not address here. So in that sense, and that's at the end of the day, the strength of the point comes just from the comparison with the theory. The problem is that at this point, we have to get rid of the matrix elements. And I will not discuss these details. And therefore, I don't. You can also see there's more spectral rate here than there. There's also depletion, but not a complete depletion. And this is, of course, then is a matter of matrix elements and other things.
But why is that yeah. Some energy dependent? Presumably, that would just depend on the final. The thing you're changing is the final state, which is somewhere out in the vacuum.
The matrix elements, they are depending on polarization, of course, and they are also depending on energy because we have some absorption edges, some cross sections which change so strongly. It's known for different atoms. That's just even calculated.
Isn't it true that changing the incident energy also allows you to probe different kinds?
Yeah, that's also done. Of course,
this
is also done. Of course, if we use so much incident energies here, we also probe in KZ typically, and this has been done. It has been also calculated here. Has been also discussed in this paper that this whole gap is not located at the gamma point, but at the Z point. But that's another story.
But could that be an answer to
also, yeah. No. Okay. But it's also known that the matrix elements strongly depend if you have absorption edges. Then of course you have a much different cross section than outside of that. So these resonances, which you can really tune by changing the photon energy, have been used to identify resonant processes and have to use to identify also lower Hubbard bands. That's also.
In this particular case, it's not KZ forces, but they see the dispersion
at this is not KZ dispersion here. KZ dispersion is very weak, and so you should not. This has nothing to do with KZ dispersion. No. Okay. Okay.
Are you going to show us some energy distribution curve? Or
no, I'm not going to show it. Let's continue. So here you see a real spectra, if you want. So let's step on. So okay, these are the same data now, and again you see differences. This has been measured again for different positions in the Brillouin zone. It has been measured for different polarizations. These are the experimental spectra. So that's all. And these are calculations from DMFT of these spectra. And these calculations, I should say, have been done before we did the measurements. That's something which has been done 2 years ago. And the only thing what we did here is we plotted these calculations in exactly the same color frame which we use here. And
so what does the green mean in these calculations?
The green means higher intensity than the blue. We can if you want to have numbers, we can have a look on that.
You're doing a one-electron calculation.
It's This is a DMFT calculation.
No?
Okay, and just have a look on this data. So what you immediately see is, again, we have these sharp renormalized bands here, and still there is trouble. It's not easy to find all details which we find in the experiment. That's something which we have to figure out. I think the renormalization is more or less as expected. That's what I learned also from the discussions with Silke. But the next thing, what you see here is, again, is this depletion of spectral rate here. And that's, okay, very qualitatively very similar to that what you see in the experiment.
There are also some features that, of course, are different. The endpoints are different.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah,
like
what
should we do to, like, the width? Yeah, we are not, come on. Give me 2 seconds. So, of course, you see here, first of all, the scale is different. So this is EV, so that's not a fit in that sense. This has been done before we did the measurements. And the width is even different. So width is larger and energy scale is larger. So the next question is, what do we see here? And then, okay, this is now very nice. We have iron selenium. We have only iron bands and we have selenium bands. So if you do the usual band structure calculation, you find the selenium bands here at this binding energy. Of course, this does not change if you do this DMFT, LDR plus DMFT. And this does also not change if you do an experiment. You see it here. And the fact that you do it, see it not clearly, is matrix elements again. This is again selenium. But now if these are the same data, just plotted in different color scale, everything is white now here in this range, but then you really see this dispersing bands here. And this is selenium. So, yeah? This is selenium is coming here at 5 eV. So we can really forget about that. The old thing, what we see here at higher, at smaller binding energies, this is all iron bands in all these three representations. And so, and what's really going on? So if you really, this is the usual band structure picture, then you do all these games, shifting bands, squeezing bands, renormalizing bands, fine. So you have these creased iron 3D bands, where you also can observe superconducting gaps and so on. Then you have a range where you lose your spectral rate, and then you have broad things. And this is what you see in both of these things, in the experiment and in the theory. And that's the thing which
Bert, yeah. Can you put back the justification? If you take extreme case, no correlation.
Yeah.
And compare with what you see in this color, yeah. Blue, yellow. That's the one that you just flashed.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
It's actually not that.
Yeah, this one and the one that you see experimentally.
Oh, yeah. The,
no, not this one.
This one.
And
what you see in experiment. Yeah.
So for
example, this here, you do not see at all.
Yeah, but if you go up a little bit, you clearly see there is a spectral weight in the middle and there is nothing at the corners exactly as you expect.
Well, okay. I'm sure that this dispersion or this part which you see here, this broad stuff, the dispersion is connected to the dispersion which is already present here. That's out of where should it come from? So, but of course, on the other hand, if you see here, just here, this band is, yeah, you basically do not see it. You also do not see it in the, and that's a funny story. So if you do the calculations, you also still see these guys here at the more or less the same positions. And in the DFT calculation, you would have to have this band, and this band is not seen neither in this calculation nor in the experiment. So
we're having a bit of a worry here as to why you call these.
Okay, this question I give back to Silke, because that's, okay, actually what I have to say, we saw that and we didn't know how to describe that. And there is, you can find a paper on the archive where Daniel, who did the measurements, plugged in some description, I would call it, some self-energy. Self-energy description, just to describe what he sees in the experiment. And then I met Silke and she said, okay, what you see there is a lower Hubbard band, and that's what...
So you accepted the description when you put it on your view graph, so you do have some ownership of it.
No.
Yeah, but going back to the previous picture, just to look at that, the position of the lower Hubbard band on the right-hand side with correlations
in the same location as the dispersing features on the network.
Not yet.
No. No correlations yet. Mm-hmm. So,
and the doesn't
so, so mm-hmm. the one on the left hand side is not a lower upper band, but the one on the right hand side is a lower mm-hmm. upper band. Why?
No, they do not. So, so if so, this is extremely, extremely broad, and that's not what you see. If you take anchor, I showed you the data. Yeah, maybe yeah.
Differences in the Fermi surfaces, details you should maybe not get worried too much. So that's
true. Cross grid of sentence UOA, that's
not
visible at all.
Okay. But for now, we look at the spectral function, and then in the theory, without looking at experiments, we found that you have a mass generalization as you expect in the DMSP picture, and quite surprisingly, there was a stacking feature building up at high energies on the TV. And we check from the theory side, of course, you can do anti-rating that cannot be determined. Namely, you can just play a little bit with the new parameters, punch it up, and we track how these features evolve, and we found what you would expect from quantum particles at low energies and above them. Namely, that quantum particles get minimized across the fermion level, whereas the second feature moves outwards. So that was from the theory side evidence that we are indeed looking at the power
time. This might be a question of terminology. But to me, it's not immune to all this anymore. That's definitely has something to do with you. To me, Hubble bands are qualitatively different from quantum particle bands because they are incoherent. And because they're incoherent, they're not supposed to be distorted particularly.
No, that's not true. Sure, because what he's saying is that at a given K, if there's a band structure, U equals zero, it would be pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Of course. So these features look rather
much
broader
than
much
what
you would expect. So it's some kind of incoherent feature.
Yeah.
It's
Look at the previous thing. You can see the vectors the same. Can we see the previous
No, but yeah. Come on. Look at these guys. Look at these are. These are experiments. Yeah, no, come on, okay, go back. These are experiments. Here you see.
Is this the main point of your talk?
No, not at all. Nevertheless, it's fine. No, let's have. So, here. Yeah. You want to see it.
But here
you have sharp peaks, and if you do measurements on compounds with
coherence of bands are two different things.
Yeah.
You may destruct coherence by interaction, but new bands don't appear. That's the question. Whether these are totally new bands or something that comes out from the pre-existing coherent band, just like
this is of course. No, it's okay, good.
You minimize quantum particle band structures, and then you get kind of an extra feature, but which cannot be dispersed. So if you think in terms of Hubble approximation, then you see that the dispersion of a Hubble band will follow the initial dispersion of the band. That's mathematically too long.
Good. I think we've got a nice point for discussion, which is how you identify.
I'm really looking forward to hear more. Hear more. Okay.
Perhaps you should carry on. That.
Okay. So that's already the story with the ARPAs, so that's okay. The expected result, that's nice. So now I go to something which is already, which will be published next week, and this is the NMR study on this iron selenium, and now I will address pneumatic order. And just as a short introduction, I take this picture from this, which has been published by these three colleagues, so Andre is sitting there, where in this paper, people really stress the importance of these pneumatic fluctuations. This is a phase diagram. Which is very close to the experimental phase diagram of this barium 1-2 superconductors. We have magnetism here, we have superconductivity in electron doped and hole doped compounds. And in addition, and that's the main point also in this paper, is there is this pneumatic order and a large temperature range where we have pneumatic fluctuations. And these statements are more or less taken from this paper. And I think these people stress, okay, and that's correct, that this pneumatic order, this breaking of symmetry, is really something which seems to be very, very important in many of these correlated electron systems, so not only stripes and cuprates. And it might be something like whatever other density wave transitions occurring in these systems. And the fact that we have pneumatic fluctuations in these iron-based superconductors, I think that's indeed well established meanwhile. But the question, what is really the origin, that remains a little bit controversial. And that's exactly the point which I will address in the next part of my talk. And people argue that it could be an orbital order mainly, or people argue that it's a spin-driven orbital order. And what you see here is, of course, the fact that indeed this long-range order, this pneumatic order, usually occurs very close to the static magnetic order. And then you can measure the order parameters here, and what you then see is, okay, you see first the pneumatic order, and then you see the magnetic order, and both, in this case, react on the appearance of superconductivity, showing that we are dealing with competing order parameters at that point. Okay, so this is the point I would like to address in iron selenium. So iron selenium has attracted a lot of attention in the last, whatever, year, because, yeah? Yeah, it's a transition from a tetragonal to an orthorhombic state usually, and the differences in lattice constants is of the order 0.3%, 0.5%, tiny,
it's
tiny.
0.3%.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah, 0.3. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is iron selenium. So experiments have been done on tiny single crystals, which were produced by these two guys from Pohang University in Korea. And this will become important later on. So this iron selenium has been, okay, there's evidence and there are some arguments that at least in thin films, very high superconducting transitions occur in iron selenium. And there's also measurements under high pressure that TC can be up to 40 Kelvin, but it's also established that if you take a poor single crystal in the bulk form, you will have a TC of about 10 Kelvin or 9.3 Kelvin. It's a rather sharp transition here. There's no magnetic order in this system. It has been established for many, many techniques. This is the resistivity. This is actually not really a bad metal. Also, the resistivity here shows a very high resistance ratio, very high quality of the sample. And you already in resistivity see there is an additional anomaly besides superconductivity, and this occurring here at 90 Kelvin. And that's the structure of phase transition, which has been already measured in the early days of iron nitride superconductors. And you see here we have a splitting of the lattice constants, so from tetragonal to orthorhombic, and yeah, the order of magnitude 0.3% or something like that. It's not a huge structural change, one can say. So volume doesn't show any anomaly, and lattice constant C is also more or less unchanged at that point. So in these crystals, we now measure NMR, and what you see here is NMR data measured for magnetic field along the C-axis and for magnetic field along the A-axis of the unit cell. And what the plot you see here, the lines are very narrow. So if you look at the scale here, that's really extremely narrow lines. It tells us that quality of samples is very, very nice. But the main thing what you see here is at this structure phase transition, there is a splitting. So you have a single line at 100 Kelvin, and then this line splits. And then we have clearly two different lines here at lower temperature. Okay, and this is selenium NMR. Selenium itself has a nuclear spin of 1/2, and this simply means that we are blind for all kind of electrical effects or for all structural effects. What we basically see here is magnetism, the magnetic field. So what we learn here is that, at least in these data, these two selenium sites have different magnetic fields at that point. And on the other hand, we know that there is no magnetic order, and this can also be ruled out from this NMR data, that we have some kind of magnetic order. You also see no splitting in the C direction. You still have these very narrow lines here. There's not even short-range magnetic order. Fine. But okay, and then if you now look at the lattice, and so you have a single selenium side, and if you do an orthorhombic distortion, that will not change that. So So that's not so easy. And the first idea was, okay, there is some other symmetry breaking. But of course, we apply a magnetic field here. And this external field is along one direction. And in this low temperature phase, we have domains. So we have A and B axis. It simply means for some of the domains, the external field is in one direction. For the other domains, it's in this direction. So the idea is that this is just due to the different domains and due to the different field orientation in this orthorhombic phase. This could be a simple explanation. And then, of course, what you would do is change the orientation of the magnetic field relative to this axis. And this is, unfortunately, not so easy because you have these tiny single crystals here. And the experiment, in order to get a signal at all, is to have to wind the coil, the NMR coil, around these tiny single crystals. So this means that the magnetic field, the RF field, is always along the AB direction. Otherwise, you cannot measure. And it simply means that the external field has to be perpendicular, so it can only be A and C direction. So what you can do easily is you can change from A or B to C direction. This has been done here, so using such a goniometer. And that's also trivial, that, this splitting disappears. We know these two cases. But I show this data also for another reason. What you see here is the shape is very different. So this measurement at 60 Kelvin, so if you compare it with this 60 Kelvin things, it's much more regular here, so here it's much broader, and the intensity is different. And this is already a fact of gluing. And this we figured out in more detail. So if you take the single crystal, glue it, and then you already see a broadening of the NMR lines. This phase transition, this tetragonal to orthorhombic phase transition becomes very broad and sluggish. So extremely susceptible for tiny, tiny effects. In a single crystal, I never saw that before. So that's really very strange. The sample. The sample. The sample has been fixed within the glue, within the coil.
Why would the gluing depend on the angle of the field?
No. Now the gluing of the sample already favors one domain for the other and already changes details of the structure that you can already then see in the bulk signal of the NMR. Yeah, but this is just a different experiment then. A different experiment which we did. So if you do different experiments, if you glue the sample, then you can get broader things.
How did you manage to avoid that problem in the previous experiment? You didn't glue it?
In the first experiment, we did not use glue, and that was the by far sharpest thing. So what you of course can do is you try to take this crystal and orient it in the 110 direction. And this we did again, and this again is fixed, screwed. So peaks are broader already at higher temperature, you see that. But here you do not see any change of the peaks as a phase transition. And this of course now supports the picture that it's really the two domains with the magnetic field orientation which determine this splitting. Yeah? Okay, that's fine. Okay, now the next thing is how to interpret that. So what we have is we have two different sites with different magnetic night shift. We are well in paramagnetic state. The night shift is hyperfine coupling times spin susceptibility plus some temperature independent chemical shift. And if you look at that, it's clear that the splitting of the lines is caused by the anisotropy of the hyperfine coupling constant. Because well in the paramagnetic state, spin susceptibility, whatever you do, whatever you model, whatever you measure, will be more or less isotropic. But this, of course, then leads really to the question, why? Why do we see a splitting? And this splitting is pretty large. It's of similar size than the difference between H parallel A and H parallel C. So we do this tiny structural distortion here, and we get a splitting which is of similar size than the anisotropy which you get for fields along C and in plane. And that's the surprise, I would say. And it's still a surprise. And of course, this is again a qualitative argument. What could help? Helping could if we really play with orbitals in some sense, that we really have domains now with different ferro orbital-like order. This is now, well, I would also say, more or less discussed, obviously. It's discussed for many experimental findings that this is a proper description. Of course, it's not an orbital order in the sense of an oxide. It's only partial change of the occupation of the orbitals. But of course, this could strongly enhance this anisotropy. Just change the lattice constant is certainly not sufficient to do that. If you do that and assume that we have such kind of an orbital order, we can introduce an orbital order parameter, and then a simple analysis shows you that indeed the relevant components of the hyperfine coupling constant will then scale with the order parameter, or in other words, our difference in the night shift, the difference in the positions, will basically measure the order parameter of this orbital order. Fine. So splitting of the NMR lines can be interpreted, or I think it's straightforward to interpret them in terms of the signature of this ferroorbital order in these systems. So this is now the temperature dependence, which you then get from the splitting of the lines. At high temperature, we have this strong decrease of the night shift, which is something which we know for ionic tides. All iron-based superconductors show that. It's something which is different from that what you would expect for a simple Fermi liquid, okay, but we are used to it. And then we have the splitting of these two lines. And then you can analyze the temperature dependence. You can analyze it close to the phase transition. And then it basically follows the behavior square root of the reduced temperature, which is just typical for an order parameter. Fine. Done. Yes. And then we have here at TC, we have a clear decrease again by about, whatever, 10% or so, a little bit more. And that's exactly the same thing which you observe also for the orthorhombic splitting. It worked. So here I showed you this order parameter. So if you do take such a sample here, do the minimatic falsification, follow the orthorhombic splitting, and then you will also find a reduction of the orthorhombic splitting of the order of 10% or something like that. That's very, very similar in this case. That's just at TC, but there is something else going on. And this is.
But you mentioned before that you couldn't extract the epsilon gradient of night shift and give you epsilon gradient?
I send you the email. I give you the absolute value. This has been instructed. This is the absolute value. This is the absolute. So also, you have that on your mail card. Yeah, 10 to the minus 3. Yeah. No? Okay, and this is something maybe we can discuss later because we come to the magnetism at the moment. So here, at least we have this change at TC, which is setting it rather sharp and telling us again, typical for competing order parameters. Fine, and this of course supports an interpretation of this transition in terms of something which is electronically driven. At least changes of the electronic structure due to superconductivity matter for this splitting.
So the delta is with respect to what?
So sorry?
140 to 100, you've got zero delta, but things are actually temperature dependent.
Okay, yeah, of course. This is splitting. This is splitting.
Leaking.
Delta is simply, it's just a splitting of the lines. No? Okay. Here, and at higher temperature, you have single line, very narrow single line, and then you have the splitting. Okay, fine. So the real new aspect comes if we now consider relaxation rate. So in the same way where we can now somehow measure these orbital order and structural distortion, of course, we have now the chance also to measure the relaxation rate for these different configurations. And the first message is, at low temperatures, we have three strongly different relaxation rates for the three different field orientations. And this, again, is easily to connect to this hyperfine coupling constants. So they are different. We saw that from the night shift. Okay, so should lead to different coupling constants here when we measure the relaxation rate. So that simply means that this strong increase, which you see here for one of these peaks, is not the spin susceptibility, it's just the temperature-dependent hyperfine coupling constants, which of course usually would like to avoid, but in this case you cannot avoid it. Probably it's better to focus here on the c-axis where this of course does not happen. That's fine. So one has to be cautious with the temperature dependence, and there are quite a lot of discussions on that also under pressure. One has to be very cautious with an analysis of these temperature dependence.
Sorry, that went by too fast.
Yeah.
Are you saying that you can see that there's temperature dependence of the hyperfine coupling because of the difference between blue and red above here?
Yeah. No. Come on. We have, this is line 2, line 1. This is line 2, line 1. Yeah. So you measure relaxation rate here and you measure relaxation rate there.
Yeah.
And you see these clear differences.
Yeah.
And if you simply take the standard formula for the relaxation rate,
yeah,
you have such a formula.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also the hyperfine coupling constant going in there. So in that sense, the same reason that splits the line here has to split these two lines. And this simply means that this strong enhancement which you see in the line two here is due to the fact of the temperature dependence of the of the of the hyperfine coupling constant, which is a consequence of the Auger model.
Do you have night shift data separately?
Yeah, yeah, of course. These are night shift data.
And the night shift is temperature independent in the region that you're looking at.
The, no, this is temperature. This is the temperature dependence of the night shift.
I'm looking at between 80 Kelvin and
below. Yeah. Here you see the temperature.
Near some transition, they will define.
Here near the transition.
Okay, the previous data is over what temperature?
It's the same.
80 Kelvin to 20 Kelvin.
Yeah.
There is a large, very interesting temperature dependence.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is not there in the night shift. Am I right?
No. It's clear. No. Come on. Okay. So, what we do, we have at high temperatures, we have this decrease of the relaxation rate, which is again typical for all iron-based superconductors. Often, it's one tries to discuss that in terms of a scaling between night shift and relaxation rate. Though, of course, temperature dependence is of course not what you expect for simple. Okay. There is no dramatic change.
It's fascinating that
what?
Night shift is not temperature dependent, whereas T1T inverse is not cutting along.
At low temperatures. At low temperatures?
Below 60 Kelvin.
Yeah, that's clear. But this is, of course, signaling the proximity of a magnetic instability. Yeah, of course.
If you play a standard game with Q dependence of the various hyperfine couplings,
yeah,
and try to extract from the data in what momentum range susceptibility may be possible in time.
Not yet, because at the moment we still are struggling with. What we need is information on the absolute values of the hyperfine coupling constant. We have to measure the anisotropy of the magnetic susceptibility, and this has not been done in the Antoine case. And there are data at higher temperatures, but they're pretty much inconsistent. So in that sense, we are just working on that, trying to get numbers and then playing the usual games. So in any case, what you see here at high temperatures, okay, that's what is typical for iron-based superconductors, which looks like a Coringa law, which is of course not because you have temperature dependence, but fine. There is no dramatic change at the ordering temperature. But at low temperatures, clear, we have this increase. Okay, one has to be a little bit cautious with the details of temperature dependence. But there is an increase telling us that we are now somehow approaching magnetic. And that's actually also seen in the data. If you see, these are very nice and very narrow lines here, and then they become broader. And that's already telling you, okay, now the system becomes magnetically dirty in some sense. So we nevertheless, at the point where we do the phase transition, the systems are magnetically completely clean. So whatever you want to do there, magnetic correlation banks are extremely small. You're really well, far, far away from a magnetic instability. So if you then go to lower temperatures, or you can follow we can now follow this peak in the relaxation rate. But it turns out that this maximum temperature here, what you see here, is basically superconductivity. So this behavior is cut at the superconducting transition, and then you have some temperature dependence. Okay, you can only follow in a very narrow temperature range, but it's also observed in many other of the arnictides for H parallel AB. For H parallel C, superconductivity is basically suppressed below 4 Kelvin or so, or 3 Kelvin. And there's something which I also do not really understand is, so this increase of the relaxation rate somehow stops here. So even if you suppress superconductivity, you do not really enter a magnetic state, which is surprising. I don't know. Okay. Yeah?
Sorry. Well, I don't recall this. I'm not a specialist in NMR.
Yeah.
So what is usually expected to see in the one over T1T approaching the sea. Isn't that so-called Hubble shortcut thing?
Yeah, but okay.
Is that what that is, or that's completely unrelated?
No, this is unrelated.
Only for pure X-ray.
So Hebel-Schlichter peak you have, if you have a very, very simple metal, you have a constant relaxation rate in the normal state, and then you have a Hebel-Schlichter peak, and then you see the gap.
But how much shock frequency, like if you take a normal metal, and now you're being convenient,
yeah.
Like how much percent was that increase in energy?
Oh, this is okay. This depends a lot on the material. In some of the materials, you do not see it at all. And you have to be very clean, but it's also much smaller than that. And this is, of course, not occurring in the superconducting state here. This is well above superconducting state. This, what you see here, is also something which we know very well. This is just slowing down of spin fluctuations. And this, so we're approaching a magnetic instability. If this guy wants to become a magnet, then this guy has to diverge. This relaxation rate diverges. And this is stopped when the system becomes superconducting, because simply you lose your firm surface. And that's what you see. That's the peak in these systems. Okay, fine. So, iron selenide has no phase diagram. It's just a compound.
Where are you in relation to the...
That's the problem.
Can you just draw the phase diagram on the board?
Okay.
Where exactly are
the pressure. Pressure to ruin the
Yeah, it's okay. but it's fine.
Your compound, there's no phase diagram.
So even the pressure is not clear. So I draw that's what people believe to be the typical phase diagram of iron-based superconductors. So we have a magnet here, so we have a pneumatic transition here, we have superconductivity here, something like that. So that's also. So iron selenium. So if I consider magnetism at 100 Kelvin, I would say I'm here. If I consider pneumatic transitions, I'm here.
So you're measuring the same compound,
though? No, this is a different compound. So this is what people believe to be generic phase diagram. And the message which will come on the screen in two transferences is that iron selenium does not fit on that. So if you take these other systems, you will have this orbital order, the structural phase transition, only if the magnetism is nearby. Here, this transition occurs in a situation where there's far away, no magnetism visible.
But this is purely empirical statement.
Yes.
In the original theoretical paper, which is the author of the
magnetism in the star. He's still dreaming of Hubble bands, okay?
There was pneumatic phase and no magnetic order at all.
Yeah? Okay, maybe.
That's one way to suppress more. There might be other ways.
So since we have a second talk, I think I've yeah.
But just ask another question. What about the phase diagram in the with pressure?
Oh,
because with pressure, I guess you can write the phase diagram similar to what.
But I'm not so sure about the pressure dependence of this magnetic order, which has been seen there with Mirsbauer. I personally don't want to.
Sure.
Discuss that at the moment. So what you usually see in if you measure the relaxation rate, you can plug that on the elastic instability. Plotted here is elastic instability, elastic constants above the structural phase transition, and then the points are measurements of the relaxation rate, telling you that the slowing down of spin fluctuations goes one to one in the same way as the softening of the lattice. And that's, I think, the nice scaling which lead to the conclusion that we really have a magnetically driven pneumatic instability. And this is taken from this paper here, from these guys, Rafael Fernandez, the theoretician, and Jörg, doing that in the experimental data from the Karlsruhe group. And you can do that for a parent compound, you can do that all for all these doped compounds. So again, elastic constant, something boring lattice stuff, and on top of that, the magnetism, and you see this one-to-one scaling. And if you try to do the same in iron selenium, you completely fail. This is again from the Karlsruhe group. Now the elastic data for iron selenium, it looks exactly like the things in the 1-2 compounds. So this looks like the typical pneumatic instability. However, in these 1 to 2 compounds, this relaxation ratio is like that. So the compounds.
What's the vertical axis there?
This.
Chi phi divided by C 660.
Yeah, this is coupling.
It's
elastic constant. It's basically the elastic. That's what the theoreticians did in order to scale that. No? Did you know that? Okay. So, coupling constant. Susceptibility. It's magnetic.
But I think what Chen is asking, what is experimentally being measured? I understand this is not your work.
No, this is measurement of the elastic constant. It's just the elastic constant, and then they plotted in this with some scales in order to plug also the 1/T1 to forget about that. It's just the elastic constant.
That's
the constant. It's just measuring the softening of the lattice, nothing else.
So, yeah,
exactly. And you see, and this you can do for the different dopings, and this what I've plotted here, you can do it here, you can do it there, you can do it there. This is the structural signature of the pneumatic instability, which you see here. And that's identical for iron, selenium, and for all the other compounds. This is the relaxation rate for the other compounds. And you will see this guy, 4%. This is something like this. Here you really, everything diverges. You're really approaching magnetic instability. So the structural phase transition occurs in a situation where your relaxation rate is already, whatever, far beyond. And that's the difference. What? No. No, that's just a softening of the lattice. Yeah, of course, here's the ordering temperature. In that sense, it's a Curie law. Yeah. Okay. Something similar to that, if you forget. So, but there's another thing. Pneumatic susceptibility has been measured also. This is Ian Fisher's group, where they measured the strain derivative of the resistivity. It's also diverging at this pneumatic transition. So it's not only the structure with response, also the resistivity and the strain derivative. And that's also a very strong statement. So, and again, if you do the same measurements, and this is Amelia Cordea's work, if you do the same measurements on iron selenium, you see exactly the same again. Again, what you measure here is resistivity, how resistivity of a sample reacts on a strain, and this diverges at this pneumatic transition. This Ian Fisher's group for barium 1-2, and the same occurs in iron selenium. And that brings me already more or less to the conclusions. So if you just look at the data for iron selenium, so we see all these signatures which we believe occur due to orbital order and the pneumatic fluctuations. So if you just consider the lattice, if you consider the electrons like electric resistivity, it's very, very similar, even identical, one can say, to the findings in all these other compounds. So all these things look very similar. The red thing looks very similar if you just consider structural on electronic properties. But the magnetic order and the slowing of spin fluctuations are simply missing in this temperature range. So, and this leads me to the conclusion that at least the conventional spin-driven pneumaticity, which has been argued, Jörg Schmalia, Fernandez, which has been argued in order to discuss this phase diagram, this can be excluded in iron selenium. That's the point. And the interpretation then means that this, for some reason, orbitals do their own game there. So they are responsible for this pneumatic fluctuation. So the fluctuations here are not connected to slowing down of spin fluctuations. And that immediately leads to the consequence that we have to assume that something like electronic fluctuations, which are not spin fluctuations, are present in these systems. And then, of course, you can speculate. You can say, OK, if these orbitals can do their own game in iron selenium, they can also do it in all other compounds. Because then the magnetism can simply follow, as usually lattice follows. And of course, if orbital fluctuations are really there, then you can again discuss also the relevance for superconductivity. So I mentioned in the beginning that for monolayers, we have completely different TCs or under pressure. And of course, everything will change. You saw already the effect of gluing. Everything will change if you take a single layer. Everything will change if you put a pressure on that. Okay, the next speculation could be that indeed orbitals could be relevant even for pairing. And that goes back to theories which have been presented in the early days. So just the conclusions, again, back to the data, not without speculations. What you clearly see are signatures of the structural transition in the NMR. You see the pronounced anisotropy of the hyperfine coupling, which suggests orbital order. I don't think that there is another way to interpret that. The angular dependence of the NMR shows that we have a ferroorbital order, which is similar to all other iron-based or many other iron-based superconductors. We have clear signatures of competition between orbital order and superconductivity. And this phase transition, or the orbital order, is basically decoupled from magnetic instability. So clear evidence for pneumatic electronic order in these compounds, but no evidence for magnetic order, origin of them. So that's, thank you very much. So I decided to skip the third part because
evidence for some kind of order, orbital susceptibility in from say polarized X-ray measurement?
No, not yet. And that's actually something which is extremely difficult to get, even measuring the orbital order here, because we do not have a simple orbital order like in the oxides.
I can believe the orbital order is responsible for the superconductivity, except it seemed to me for what you showed us was happening to the spin order. In other words, I admit it was decoupled from your pneumatic order. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to come on very strong as you lowered the temperature, as if it were coming on just before the superconductivity. So I wonder why that last line was added in your previous slide.
Under speculations. It was just a speculation. No, it's clear. What is clear is when we do this orbital order, we support the usual magnetism. Maybe there even. The reason that there is no magnetism at 100 Kelvin visible here, that's also something which one has to discuss, probably some frustration, I don't know. And of course, if we then do the orbital order, we change exchange constants, and then we support the usual magnetic order, and this is the reason for the enhancement of solarization.
And the origin
of
superconductivity.
I guess the issue is, as you repeatedly said, it's a line compound, iron selenide, and imagine that if there wasn't a superconductivity, that is, if any ferromagnetic transition temperature were to be lower than the superconductive transition temperature, mm-hmm. so then you would not have seen anything yet mm-hmm. in the magnetic order. But too close to the critical point.
Yeah, but what I see is, of course, I see one kind. But the main message is really you can decouple these two transitions. I think that's you see that.
Yeah. I'm not an expert on this, but you say that you rule out magnetic order. Can you rule out a scenario in which you have sort of equal and opposite moments, like two distinct orbitals, such that there's no net moment, but within each orbital there's an equal and opposite moment? That's a sort of a pneumatic order, but in the spin channel.
So what I can rule out is any kind of static magnetic order.
Sure.
What I can rule out is any kind of short-range magnetic order with a sizable correlation length.
Yeah, the reason I bring this up is because of the comment that Doug made, that there's some sort of anomalous relaxation.
There should be visible in the neutrons.
Yeah.
Okay, and people have...
But nobody sells in neutrons.
So, other questions from people who haven't said that much? Oh, but you can't say that.
I'll answer it here. No, go ahead.
So I just wanted to make a remark on what Chandra asked. So there is a pressure dependence, which Bernd doesn't seem to believe in, but at least at the phase value. If you apply about 1 GPa of pressure, there is an onset of anti-ferromagnetism, which appears to be about first order.
That's exactly
concerning the question, well, could it be that there is a anti-ferromagnetism, but the TNEL would be lower than TC or superconductor.
Yeah, but that's not a problem. That's what you see in the data. So if you believe this increase here,
right.
So this usually occurs only if the correlation length becomes larger, the fluctuation frequency becomes slower, it becomes comparable to the Larmor frequency, and typically you would then expect that it somewhat diverged. Okay, TC, well, maybe. There's no question.
Right. Provided the second order, right? Let's agree on that. So yes, the relation length would diverge if this was second on a phase transition. All I wanted to point out is that if I believe at face value the pressure measurements, the transition suggestively is first order, not second order, and happens at a much higher pressure.
I do not read it.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe we can discuss it.
I just want to make some information points. Can you actually flip back to your pre-conclusion slide? Penultimate slide.
Yeah, it's the speculations.
So just to set for information purpose. Number one, for spin-driven emetistic scenario, the slowness or fastness of heat fluctuation is immaterial. They could be as fast as possible, and it would still have this.
I disagree. I disagree because the lattice cannot follow them, because lattice is slow.
So in order
to be responsible for...
I can explain why the case, but at the moment you have to trust me or Andrei or anybody else who is doing emeticity. That's immaterial. That does not matter, because the spin fluctuations play in the same way. So they can fluctuate...
But not the order. You can, of course, high energies, okay, fine, but the ordering what we see here cannot be done in this way.
Well, yes. So let me just repeat the statement, and then if you request proof, I can quote proof later. Then in the spin-driven Matisse scenario, which is developed by Georges, Malan, Andre, and many other people, the frequency does not matter. What matters is that there is this balance between spin fluctuations at zero pi and pi zero. But they can be as fast as needed. Number two is that in the... there is nowhere in the theory which requests that the ordering would occur at some temperature close to pneumatic order transition. If there is any physical reason to suppress long-range magnetic order, and dimensionality is only one of them, then you would go back to his original Coleman, Chandra, Larkin paper. And the first and the last piece of information is like this. If you do density function calculations, and I mean that the real density function, not DMFT, I mean there is no adjustable parameter at all whatsoever, no U, no J, just standard thing. You get structure, right, if you allow for magnetic order. So then this distortion of the right amplitude follows immediately, and that's true for all materials, for H2S2, even for cuprates, which are much more correlated than these things. So either you believe that this is pure coincidence, that for nictites, for selenites, for all of them, you get this absorbing distortion, right? And where there is no magnetism accompanying it, you get the correct size of the distortion, and so on. Or you should believe that there is some correct physics incorporated there, and that's magnetic physics. If you don't allow for magnetism, you never get any sort of...
But in the theory, but an experiment shows no magnetism. That's a problem.
Yeah, that's not...
Yeah, of course, I know that the theory predicts that, but the real world doesn't show it. So, fine.
So, can I just say, this sort of coupling between the pneumatic and the spin physics actually started before with the J1, J2 type model. Now, in FETE, we know that that model has to be generalized if you want to have any chance. Mm-hmm. Of describing the pi half
yeah.
magnetic order, and for good reasons which could also apply to FESE. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make a comment that if you're following that line of thinking, and if you take a J1, J2, J3 plus some interactions which are allowed by symmetry, there are phases which are very much compatible with the
The problem is, okay, and that's again addresses also Igor's comment. We have this phase transition, which is a slowing down of these whatever fluctuations you have, pneumatic fluctuations.
Yeah.
So and the time scale close to the phase transition is extremely slow, otherwise you will not get static. So and we can rule out anything magnetic on the same time scale.
You can rule out anything static which is in a dipolar channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we can rule anything what we can see here in the understanding.
I think in the interest of time, we're going to have to move on. Andre, you want to say one
thing? I just wanted to ask a quick question. I only have one, but just for the record. putting in a totally different limit. Suppose that, well, I was myself very much in favor of spin-driven demagnetics. Suppose that it's really very different from other systems. Is it true that if we look at the possibility that it's just a structural transition driven by phonons, that's the only experiment so far the question is the one that the molecular data? Because you showed it. Because when you showed structural constants, they just behave, they just increase on their own.
So it could be a simple structural phase transition which has a strong consequence on. Okay, we still have the hyperfine coupling constants.
Sure, but you need to have it anyway.
You have some kind of orbital order there. There is, of course, this change at TC, telling us that then the structural order parameter somehow depends or is speaking with superconducting transition, which already tells us that it's not purely structural. So it's enhanced by some electronic display. And then, of course, you have the electric nematicity, but this is, again, orbitals which could follow the structural.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think at that point we should move on. Thank you very much.